Now, we've been working through this biography of Jesus, the Gospel of John, for on and off for quite a few months now, and we've seen John recount for us a number of miracles that Jesus has performed. Some of them are some of the most famous, if you like, in the Bible, like Jesus turning the water into the wine, or last week the story of Jesus healing the official's son. And I don't know if you've picked up on this, but when John is talking about these miracles that Jesus did, he calls them signs. All right? The miracle is a sign pointing to something beyond itself. The problem with it is that the miracles are often so extraordinary that they become like the focus of our attention. So instead of them being a sign pointing to something else, and we let go, okay, I just need to kind of follow that and see what it is the sign is pointing me to, we just become like totally obsessed with the sign. It'd be like, you know, I'm going, we're off to Sizewell to a camp over at Sizewell Hall or something, and we're following the signs to Sizewell, and before we get to Sizewell Hall, we stop at one of these signs for Sizewell Hall, we're like, oh, this is a great sign. And we just sort of stay there all week looking at the sign. You'd be like, oi, that's not what a sign does. You're not supposed to focus on the sign. What you're supposed to do is follow the sign and get to where the sign is pointing you. And it's the same with these miracles, okay? The thing is, when Jesus is performing these miracles, he's wanting to teach us something about himself. In a sense, it's not the miracle in itself that is supposed to be the thing we focus on. We're supposed to be reading through the biography of Jesus, watching the things that Jesus does, and saying, okay, what is it that this is pointing us to, all right? What is it that Jesus is wanting us to learn about him? I mean, it's amazing that people get healed and stuff. Fantastic. Don't want to knock that at all. But if we just focus on that, we're kind of missing the point of what it is that Jesus is doing. He wants us to look through the miracle, through the healing, through the sign, to what it is that he wants us to learn. All right, what's the lesson that Jesus is wanting us to take away? Now, the problem with those of us who've been hanging out around church for a while is that we become so familiar with some of these stories that we lose the shock factor in this. All right, but just put yourself in the scene that we've just had painted for us as Roger read from us from John chapter 5. All right, we're in this place called Bethesda, which is it's a great name. It's called the House of Mercy. That's what the name Bethesda means. When you translate it, it means the House of Mercy. And you're thinking, oh, this is brilliant. What's going to happen here? The place is called House of Mercy. And you walk into it, and it's just full of people with all kinds of disabilities and ailments and illnesses. And they're all gathered around this pool. And there's this sort of superstition about the pool in this place. That when the waters are stirred, the first person to get in is healed. Now, I have no idea what to make of that. All right? I mean, I don't know. It's like, was that really something that happened? Or was it just something that the kind of a legend or a myth had kind of grown up around? But I mean, can you imagine how desperate you must be to pin your hopes on this? You're just going to sit there and wait, and if the water starts to move, it's going to be like a race, and the first one in gets it. I mean, the whole situation is kind of a bit strange, right? But how desperate would you have to be that you're banking on that to get healed? Right, you must have tried every other option, and there is nowhere else you can go before you get to the point where, like, this is it. I'm at the pool of Bethesda. You know, it's like, really? And then there's this guy who's been there for, like, 38 years. Just sitting, waiting, hoping that one day his day will come. All right? And into this despair into this hopelessness, into this misery, Jesus walks and does one of the most unchristian things that you could possibly imagine. He ignores pretty much everybody in the whole room. Now, isn't that weird? I mean, this is Jesus, right? Jesus, who has got a track record by this stage of walking, you know, he arrives at a region and people from miles around are bringing their sick and their suffering and their demon possessed and you know, even people who are dead, you know, and Jesus is dealing with, and he deals with everything. You know, and there are these moments in the stories of Jesus where the disciples are absolutely wrecked and it's like late into the night and Jesus, no, we're just going to keep going because there are more people who need healing. There are more people. And then he comes to the Pool of Bethesda, right? Probably the place where there are more sick people than anywhere else in the world. And he ignores pretty much everybody. You see, when you're reading about it, you've got to stop and think about things like that. The problem is we're so familiar with the story, it doesn't even register that that's kind of strange. But that is a little bit odd. That when Jesus is confronted with so much human need, he says nothing and he does nothing. Except for this one guy. There's this one guy in the midst of all of this. He's been there for like nearly 4 decades, which just for the record is almost as long as I've been alive. All right, so this guy has been there probably since he was a kid. Yeah, he's been there a long time. And out of all this sea of human need and misery and pain and suffering and struggle, Jesus picks this one guy, walks up to him, and even now he doesn't heal him. Isn't this, again, there's something very odd about this. Jesus walks up to this guy and he's like, mate, do you want to get well? Like, you've been here for 40 years. You know, do you actually want to get well? That's an interesting question. Yeah. You would assume, right, that you can take that one for granted, Jesus. You know, like, here's a guy who's been paralyzed for nearly 4 decades. He's in the house of mercy. He's hoping against hope that somehow there might be some truth in this legend, this superstition, this myth that has grown up around this place. Maybe, just maybe, this is my last chance. Maybe I can be healed. Surely it's a given. But Jesus walks up to this guy and he's like, mate, you've been here for 40 years. Do you actually want me to heal you? That's an extraordinary question, but it's a question. I'm going to say this, and this might upset some of you, but it's a question that's worth pondering. Because, like, I've been a minister now for like 20 years, and I was involved in some stuff as a Christian leader before that as well. And you know, I have met in that time an awful lot of people who actually don't want what Jesus has to offer. Or let me put that in a slightly more sophisticated way. They would like what Jesus is offering, but they don't want to have to make the changes that they would need to in order to be able to receive it. That actually, sometimes there are people who, you know, you talk to them and there's no pretending that life is not hard. You know, nobody's pretending that things are going well. Often people are quite willing to put their hands up and accept that they've made a bit of a train wreck of life. Things are not going well, but when Jesus comes and says, well, look, I can sort this out, but you'll need to be my disciple. I can reach into this and I can bring resolution here. I can bring healing. I can give you a future and a hope, but you're going to have to do things differently going forward. Actually, it's amazing how many people say, no, I'm not prepared to change how I'm living. I'm not prepared to change who I am. You know, if Jesus could sort things out, that would be great. But I don't want it to have to impact how I live. And so actually, on balance, people bizarrely are quite happy to stay in a train wreck of a life if it means they don't have to change, rather than let Jesus bring healing and resolution and forgiveness and a future and a hope if it means they have to change to become the people Jesus is calling them to be. Now, we see this quite often in alpha courses and stuff. I mean, it was great on Friday night. We had a prayer event on Friday night at St. Andrews. And in that, Matt and Katie both stood up and they were talking about how just recently, over the last few months, they've kind of become Christians, or their faith has been reawakened. It's a very, very powerful thing hearing these people talk about the way in which God has met with them. We baptized Dean last Sunday night. Again, he's a really shy guy, so he wasn't going to stand up and talk in front of a whole bunch of people. But again, just the way God has met with him and has dealt with him, he's working out, what does this mean for me? How does this mean now I have to change and be different? But it's amazing how many people, they're not willing to do that. Actually, I'm not willing to change. Yeah, I know my life is hard. I know there is struggle. I know there is sorrow. But I'm not prepared to change in the way Jesus would want me to in order for there to be healing and a future and a hope. Jesus comes to this one guy. This one guy out of all the multitude that are in this place, the House of Mercy. He comes to this one guy. He's like, do you want to get healed? And it's almost like the question doesn't make sense. You know, it's like, I've been sick for so long, I can't even imagine what it would be like to be made well again. Now, why has Jesus zeroed in on this guy? This one guy. Out of all these people, he zeroes in on this one guy. Why? Well, could we have verse 14 up on the screen? Please, Meg. That would be helpful, I think. Verse 14. Because I think this is actually the key that's going to unlock the passage for us. Now, again, this is something that Jesus says that you just don't think, I'm just not sure that's very Christian. You know, it's just not what you would expect Jesus to do. Because after he heals him and everything, Jesus finds this guy again and says, right, listen, mate, what you need to do, you're well again, now stop sinning or something worse might happen to you. Now, just again, we read that and we just kind of keep reading. And we don't realize how shocking a thing that is. Right. What is Jesus saying to this guy? He's saying, look, mate, the reason that you've been sick for the last 38 years is because of your sin. That's weird. And it's really weird. Those of us who've been doing the Bible read through over the last few weeks, we're reading through the whole Bible this year as a church. Do you remember the book of Job we were in a few weeks ago? And Job's comforters say this, don't they? They say to Job, buddy, the reason that you are suffering is because of your sin. Sort your sin out and the suffering will stop. And what does God say about that? It's like everyone's like, oh, I can't remember. It was like 2 weeks ago, can't remember. Right? God's like, that is not true. That is not true. In John chapter 9, so just a few chapters on in this biography of Jesus we're reading through at the moment, the disciples come to a guy who was born blind. And their question to Jesus is, so, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that this man is born blind? And again, what does Jesus say? Hang on, this is not because somebody sinned. You see, over and over again in the Bible, the Lord attacks this idea that when you suffer, it's because you've sinned. It's because you've done something that God's not happy with. And so you're suffering because he's punishing you for something that you've done wrong. And so many people, like the reason this is such a big deal in the Bible is because so many people, they have this thing in their head, you know, where stuff's going wrong in their lives. There's something that's causing huge pain and huge sorrow, and they're thinking, oh, what did I do wrong? I must have done something wrong to deserve this. And over again, like the Bible is really clear, it doesn't work like that. There's not a straight line correlation between something you did wrong and your suffering. All right, that generally speaking is not the way the world works. That's not the way God works. Which is why I think for most people at the Pool of Bethesda, Jesus ignores them. Because their suffering has not been the result of something that they have done wrong. And Jesus is looking for someone that he can, this is going to sound a bit mercenary, but he's looking for someone he can use as a sign. Remember, the point is not the healing. The point is, what is the healing pointing to? And Jesus is wanting to teach people that he can deal with the reality of their sin. And in order to do that, he is looking for the exception to the rule. He's looking for that one person in this crowd for whom actually, do you know what? Because this does sometimes happen, doesn't it? There are exceptions to the rule where I am suffering because of something I did years ago. And in the midst of all this suffering, all these people, Jesus is looking for this one exception to the rule, the one person for whom they're suffering, the reason they are there is because of something they did. Because Jesus wants to show them, not just that he can heal people, but that he can deal with the sin that for this one guy has caused his paralysis. Right? All the way through the Gospels, there may be two or three moments like this, where Jesus says, okay, this has happened because of sin. It was somewhere along the road where you rejected God's vision for your life. You rejected God's wisdom. You ignored my teaching. And things have gone bad for you as a result of that. And Jesus picks this one guy out because that's true of this one guy. And he says, right, I'm going to deal with this. I'm going to deal with it publicly in a way that people can see so that it can be a sign so that people know I can deal with the sin that has caused this. Right, you can't always do that, draw a straight line from sin to suffering. But occasionally you can. And this is one of those exceptional moments. And so Jesus goes to this guy and he says, right, I can heal you. And he heals him. And then he comes back and he says this to him. Now listen, mate, you need to stop sinning or something worse will happen to you. You know, that guy spent, isn't it bizarre? This guy has spent 40 years sitting at the pool at Bethesda, looking back on whatever it was he did, going, I wish I had never done that. But now, here in this moment of healing and restoration, Jesus has to come back and find him and say, look, buddy, don't go back and do it again. See, there has got to be change. Right, when Jesus steps into somebody's life, when Jesus brings restoration, when he brings healing, when he brings wholeness, when he brings reconciliation, when he gives people a future and a hope, when Jesus reaches out in grace and touches someone in this way, there has to be a reaction, there has to be a response, there has to be change. When Paul was one of the early Christian leaders, and he was training up some pastors. One of them was a guy called Titus, and he wrote a letter to this guy, and in it he talks about the grace of God that has appeared. And he says, the grace of God that has appeared, and listen very carefully to this, the grace of God that has appeared, that offers salvation to all people, and it teaches us to say no to worldly passions and ungodliness, and to live self-controlled, upright, and godly lives. See what happens when God's grace impact somebody's life. It changes them. It has to be different going forward. You can't just keep going back to the same habits and the same patterns of behavior and the same ways of treating people. You can't do that. When God's grace touches you, there has to be transformation. Because otherwise what happens is you just slide back into the same paralysis. See, that's the thing with this guy. He's a sign, isn't he? His physical paralysis is an outward, visible expression of his spiritual paralysis. Right? Jesus is really clear on this. He says, look, everyone who sins becomes a slave to sin. You become trapped by it. And if I come along and liberate you, and then you just go back and sort of re-engage with that pattern of behavior, you're just going to get enslaved again, and it'll be worse next time round. See, when grace touches us, when God reaches into our lives and brings this moment of transformation, we can't go back to what we were before. We have to be different. Now, do you know what I love about this guy in John 5 is how utterly clueless he is the whole way through. You know, because I think we often think, oh, if I'm going to meet with God in this way, I have to be really on the ball. I have to be seeking. I have to be working hard. I have to be pursuing God. And if I do that, then maybe I'll find him. But I want you to see how different it is in this passage, all right? This guy is not looking for Jesus. This guy, even when Jesus walks into the room, this guy doesn't even know who Jesus is. He doesn't call out to Jesus. He doesn't try to get Jesus' attention. Nothing. And even when Jesus heals this guy, and afterwards the authorities are like, hang on a minute, what's going on here, buddy? You're healed. Why? Who healed you? And his answer is brilliant, isn't it? It's like, I have no idea. I don't know who this guy was. And even when Jesus comes back to him, like now Jesus has to begin to teach him. And what you see is like we were saying when we were baptizing Evie Bella this morning. You know, it's not about us going out and pursuing God and seeking God. And if I work really hard and if I'm a good enough person, maybe I'll find God. Right? This whole passage is telling us it's the other way around. It is Jesus who is coming to find this guy. And when this guy hasn't got a clue about what's going on, or what he needs, or why he needs it, it is Jesus who is dealing with him. It is Jesus who is healing and restoring him. And then he says, this needs to change you. You need to be different. Now, let me finish with this little section here, okay? Why is John writing? Why does he, of all the things that he could have said about Jesus, and at the end he does say, you know, if I tried to write down everything that Jesus said and did, there literally wouldn't be enough books in the world to record everything. So he's had to make some choices. Now, why has he chosen to pick this story out of Jesus' life and to tell it the way that he has? I think it's because John is he's a pastor, right? You know, John is he's leading a church in a place called Ephesus. And we know that because he writes some other letters in the Bible and he tells us that this is who he is and this is what he's doing. And you know, here's the thing, as a pastor, my hunch is that he is wanting he's wanting to encourage the people in his church to think. And to think deeply about Jesus. See, think about this story. The way John tells it. The story starts with this guy who is in the house of mercy. But who is expecting nothing. He's been going to the house of mercy for years and has never been changed, never been healed, has never been transformed. He's not expecting to meet Jesus. He's not looking to meet Jesus, which is kind of strange in itself, because Jesus has been around for a little while by this stage, and his reputation has grown, and people know who he is, and they know what he's doing. And yet this guy still isn't looking for Jesus. And in fact, when Jesus comes, he doesn't even recognize who Jesus is. There's no desire, and there's no expectation. And even when Jesus meets with him and drives home his grace and his power to heal, even then Jesus has to say to this guy, look, this has to change you. You have to be different as a result of what's happened in this moment. And you see, my hunch is that the message that John is wanting to convey to his people is to just challenge them gently. You know, there's a church downtown, isn't there? And they've actually called that church Bethesda, haven't they? What a great name for a church. This is the House of Mercy. Brilliant name for a church. But how many people go to the House of Mercy? No expectation that anything is going to be different. No desire for anything to be different. How many people go to the House of Mercy and they wouldn't know Jesus literally if he walked up to them? And even if he did, they would have no notion about what it is that Jesus wants to do. And if they did experience his grace and his power, they wouldn't be prepared to change as a result of it. They would just go back out and carry on living their life the same way they've always lived it, and would very happily put themselves back into the paralysis and the slavery that sin brings. And I think this is John's point. He's warning us not to be like that. Then when you come to the House of Mercy, you need to come desiring, expectant, ready for Jesus to confront you and to touch your life with his grace. And when he does that, you need to be ready to walk out of here to live a different kind of life. Because if you meet with Jesus, if Jesus meets with you and you walk out and ignore that and just carry on living the same old way, the paralysis and the slavery of sin will slowly take hold of your life again. John's saying, don't be like that. Come expectant, come desiring. And when Jesus meets with you, when you are touched by his grace and his power to heal, walk out a different person, living a different way, saying no to worldly passions and ungodliness, and instead living self-controlled, upright, and godly lives, because that is what the grace of Jesus is wanting to achieve today.